Spotify asked, Fairly.
That's a pretty name. And she's from La Mesa, and she's going to share her experience with the help.
My name is Fairley, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's really a joy to be here, and okay, so experience, strength, and hope. Let me say this about that, is I have been sober a lot longer than I actually was even alive before I came in here. I got sober in 1964, May 25th, 1964, that was it, only... Five. That's a hard 5 years. Anyway, so I'm going to say a little bit about what it used to be like, and then I want to talk about my journey in recovery, because that's what's important to me. What it was like is a lot like the young woman who spoke before me. I was born into a fear of death by drinking, and... It was very normal. Easter was expected that we would hunt for eggs and our parents would either have hangovers or be working their way to an eventual hangover or be fighting with each other over God knows what. Holidays were hell. And I can remember being maybe 8 or 9 years old and thinking, these people are nuts. They're absolutely nuts. And I remember thinking to myself that I thought I had figured out that the crux of their problem was that they drank alcohol, and that they wouldn't drink, because I did have a few renegade relatives who didn't drink, and when I went to their house, I noticed that things like that were happening at my house didn't happen at their house, so I said, what is the, you know, like in like when you're first grade, one of these is not like the others. Well, you know, the thing of it is, one of these is not like the others, and my Aunt Elizabeth doesn't drink, so, you know, perhaps. So I told myself I was never going to drink, ever. Because I wasn't going to behave like that. So I was about 12, maybe, roughly. My father was a volunteer fireman. I grew up way out in the sticks up in Washington State. And they decided to, for the fireman's ball, that they would sequester all of us children on one farm and leave the older ones, which would have been me, all 12 years of my age itself, in charge of this group of children. And one of the other 12-year-olds thought that it would be a great idea if we got in our parents' liquor cabinet and we put alcohol in, you know, put like, I think we put whiskey in the milkshakes or something like that. It was pretty awful, but enough chocolate, you can gag anything down. And, you know, gin and Kool-Aid. Yeah, the gin and Kool-Aid. And as the evening evolved, I had a clear understanding of why my parents drank, and I felt that there was nothing wrong with that, you know, and I was now one of them, somewhere in my heart. Long story short, things went downhill from 12 to 15. 15, I left home, went out to find my way in the world. I ran away, I got married, I had a baby, I moved around the United States, I went to Hawaii for a while, then I ended up in Mexico. My main reason for wanting to live in Mexico is nobody asked for ID. It's the truth. I was down there, I went into a bar, and I ordered a drink, and nobody said anything, nothing, just gave it to me. Cerveza Mexicali, por favor, who can't learn that? So, you know, I was in heaven. And my drinking got really, really bad, really, really quick. And one day, I was living in this little trailer park down on the ocean, below Tijuana, before Ensenada, and some people came. I hadn't been sober in a while, and I would think to myself that I'd look at my little girl, who was about 3, and I'd think, I'm not a very good mother, I'll have a drink. I won't feel so bad about it. So these people came in, and I noticed that they weren't drinking, which bothered me. So they were in my cantina, you know, in my trailer park, and they weren't drinking. And it started to really get to me as the day wore on, and so I went over and I said to them,
why aren't you drinking, you know? And the one man said to me, there was two men and a woman, and he said, we find it curious that it bothers you. And I and I thought, what an idiot. You know? You know, but interestingly enough, the night before I had gotten back to the resort by the skin of my teeth, and you know, I'd been in a bar called Latinos Americanos in downtown Tijuana, and I let somebody give me a ride home, and it was a near fatal experience. And so I remembered standing outside my chateau. I had a trailer on a cliff, you know, and I had a view. So I remember standing there, and I remember looking out, and there was one of those phosphorus tides that, you know, that was coming in, and the sea was all shiny. And I'm from a farm up in the Northwest. I'd never seen anything like that. And I said, dear God, if there is a God, for God's sakes, help me, because there's something wrong with me, and I don't even know what it is. And then the next day, these people arrived. So they really were bugging me. They were bugging me. The next day, they were sitting there drinking coffee, all pleasant and happy. And by noon, I'd had it. So I went over and I said, are you putting anything in that coffee? And they said, no, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what the hell is that? And they said, we'd love to tell you about it. Because they'd been watching me while I'd been watching them. And they were pretty sure I was a mess. And I said, yeah, whatever. So later that night, I thought, well, maybe I will look into this. And these people told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was interested. I thought, wow. What they said, and what I want to share with you, and it wasn't an easy journey, so I want to get that real straight. I remember what this man said to me. His name was Lucky. Lucky. He said, the thing of it is, you won't understand this. In time, you will. But if you'll come with us, go back to the United States, stay in one of their homes, one of them let me stay in their home for a while, and go to meetings, that I promise you, you will never have to feel like this. One day at a time, you will never have to feel like this again for as long as you live. And I was so worn out. That's what I was. I was worn out. You know, alcohol was my best friend. I counted on alcohol since I was 12 years old to make absolutely everything okay. Anything, any shit that was going on down in my life, I didn't have to worry because relief was just a swallow away. I'd moved along into, like, I weighed like a whole, hard to believe now, but I weighed like a whole, like maybe 100 pounds, and I was on diet pills, you know, because I found a doctor in Hawaii that would give me all the Dexedrine I could eat, and all the Milltowns to bring me down off the Dexedrine, and then I drank too. So there's where these people found me. I was getting up in the morning, I was taking speed, then if I got a little bit jittery, I was taking some Epobamate to calm myself down so that I could drink all night. And that's how I lived. And couldn't trust myself or anybody else in the world. I didn't love myself. I didn't care about myself. I wasn't sure how I felt about all y'all, but I was pretty sure that I could be a homicidal maniac and with no problem. You know, just give me enough drugs. So that's where those people found me. And they're good for their word. They brought me back across into the United States, and I hung out around in AA people's homes for about a month, and then some ladies thought that perhaps my lifestyle over here in recovery was I might be a little bit exploited, you know. I was a mere teen, and I was living from pillar to post. So these ladies kind of took me under their wing. Big Tony, she's gone now. She'd gotten out of prison for murdering her husband while under the influence of alcohol. And another lady who passed away as well. They're all gone now. Because this is the deal. I look around this room, I see an awful lot of what used to be considered young people when I got sober. I was so young. I was so young that there was a group called the 2040 group, and they wouldn't let me in. I used to have to sit on the porch and listen through the window. Because I couldn't participate. That was their young people's group in 1964. So, you know, when I got sober, it was one of these things where the people that came into Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, they were, I mean, they talked about stuff like the Keeley Cure. Does anybody here know what the Keeley Cure is? Raise your hand if you know what the Keeley Cure is. See, look. Look at this crowd. Look at it. They talked about, the Keeley Cure is where they took you in and they tried to make you drink yourself to death. You know, it's aversion therapy. It was the original, it was like 1925 to 1935, the Keeley Cure. They were certain. I mean, there's a lot of happy people going, I'll sign. show me the dotted line. You know, I mean, these people were you know, they were good. They came into Alcoholics Anonymous with the hope of just living their final years with some serenity and a modicum of good health. But then there was myself and the people between 20 and 40, not very many of those either. And we were a different kind of people coming into AA. I'll talk more about that maybe. Anyway, I sort of got off track. But so those three women, they got me into Crossroads Foundation. Bernice Morris was the founder of Crossroads Foundation. She was an attorney. She'd never drank a drop in her entire life, but she, like many of us, came from a raging alcoholic home, and in an attempt to save her sister Madge from the dregs of alcoholism, she'd started a woman's recovery home. She used to go down to the county psych ward at UCSD Medical Center, which was then called County Hospital, and jail. And she would have the police sometimes bring women to her. And so that's where I went. I went to Crossroads Foundation up on 4th Avenue. I remember when I went in there, I was taking a shower, and I thought, oh, wow, now what the hell have I gotten myself into? Let me take a little side note, is that I had also given my daughter in my last drunk, my three-year-old daughter, I'd given her to this person to babysit her, and I couldn't remember where they lived. It's a horrible thing. So I've been sober a month trying to figure out, no, wait a minute. I've been sober a while, trying to find my daughter. And I knew the woman's name. That's all I knew. And these ladies told me when they took me to Crossroads Foundation that Miss Morris was an attorney and she would help me find this. Things weren't quite as sophisticated then. I would have just Googled her now, but, you know, they didn't have that then. So I remember I was showering and this old lady white hair in a bun, whipped the shower curtain open and said, are you the new girl? I was like, she says, oh, just finish your shower and come out. I have some things I need to talk to you about. And I thought, who in the hell's that? And I wrapped a towel around and I came out. And she goes, I don't even know why I'm bothering myself. You'll never stay. You're too young. And I thought, you'll have to blow me out of this place. You know, later she told me, she said it was all she could think of to say. She was so afraid that I would book, you know, that she was just like going, well, if I say this and she's really an alcoholic, it'll have a hard time getting her to move out. And so a year and a half later, you know, we sat down and had another talk when she told me that she thought it was time for me to leave. You know, I had a job. And she found my daughter within 24 hours. And we got her into a safe setting and I went into on with my recovery process. So that's how my recovery began, and that's all I'm really going to talk about, my drinking. In the beginning, when I first got sober, I kept waiting to feel better. I did. And, you know, I went to a lot of meetings. Back in those days, and I don't know how it is now, it seems somewhat different. Alcoholics Anonymous seems a lot different to me now than it was when I first got sober. But here, nowadays, people are so high-functioning, you know, that you, like, work AA into your schedule. You, no, really. I mean, I'm my hat's off to you. I think it's pretty, I'm impressed, you know. But it seems as how most of us that came in back in the 60s had no jobs, and probably nobody was willing to pretty much hire us. And we were kind of living from hand to mouth, almost everybody. So what we did was we went to meetings constantly, you know, and then tried to work our life into around our meetings. So, oh, Jesus. Sorry, buddy. Tried to work our life. I obviously talked. We worked our life around our meetings, not our meetings around our life. And I think it's a good thing that now people can work their meetings around their life, because it means that people are actually coming in here who have lives. So, that's a good thing. It's a good thing. So I kept going. I went to a meeting every single day, and sometimes three meetings on Sunday. And I was just absolutely the dimpled darling of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a hell of a cross to bear, I'm here to tell you. You know, I was like the youngest person. Only one other person as young as me who lived up in Long Beach. Her name was Suzanne. And I used to go up to the Laguna Beach Club and meet with her, hang out with her once a month. And everybody else was significantly older. And so I kept going to meetings, and they called on me, and I tried to give great, cheerful talks. But I was dying. I was dying. It was horrible. I hope there's nobody here going through that, but if you are, hey, trust me, you can live through it. I couldn't figure out what the hell I was doing wrong. I went to meetings. I read the chapter 5. I was a secretary. I was dating a guy in recovery. That should have counted for something, Then somebody read me that boy meets girl on AA campus. Love follows at first sight. Not a good thing. That's paraphrasing, but it says don't do it. But I was doing it. I was even going to marry him, and I did. But that's another story. So... Oh, wow. My friend Bill Miller, that I just love and adore, he always says, alcoholics don't have relationships, they take hostages. So, unless we're in recovery. When we're recovering, it's not like that. There's hope. So, I was miserable. And then I thought, well, maybe it was because I probably should be living with my boyfriend. So I moved in with him. And there we were living in our little apartment in North Park. But then I had a job. I actually had a career path. I was working for a oral surgeon. I was going to school. I was a surgical oral surgeon's assistant. And I had my daughter back, and life was going along pretty good. And Miss Morrison and I both agreed that I couldn't live at Crossroads forever, so I moved out. And I lived in a little apartment over on Thorne Street. And then I moved in with the boyfriend. So here I am. And I'm thinking to myself, I can't go on like this. I mean, all these people in AA are going to be so disappointed when I kill myself, because that is all I can think of to do. I don't really want to drink again, and I don't want to live like this. And so I remember I was in the tub in the apartment on Redwood, and I was thinking to myself, God, I just can't do this anymore. I just can't do it. I'm not going to drink, but I'm not going to continue living either. And I put my head back, and my mind said, now usually up till now, my mind had been my worst enemy, but something got through, and my mind said, you know those steps they like read about, they read like in the, like chapter 5 at the meetings? I wonder what those are. Because I'd never read past that in the book. I've never gone past that part of the book, And I thought, I don't know. Well, there's some crazy people out in Spring Valley that have this thing they call a triangle group, and they're always trying to recruit people, but the old-timers said stay away from them. They're nuts. Well, that's just my kind of people. So I thought, I'll get in touch with those people with that step study on Friday nights, and then I'll do those darn steps, and if anything... If something doesn't change, then I'll kill myself. So I did. I contacted these people, and I started going to the step study groups. And now I could sit down and say I lived happily ever after in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's not quite how it worked. What happened was, is I began to see the value in really living one day at a time, really staying in the now. It's a really hard thing for me to do. It really is. I'm either regretting something that I did or said or even thought, maybe, or I'm fearful of something I'm going to do or say or think, But rarely, rarely in those days was I ever in the moment. I grew up in a place, in a really dark, dark place. I'm not talking about the cloud layer that we have in the Northwest. That's bad enough. But my life was very dark. I'd never seen people embrace life or be happy. It seemed like there was always some high drama situation going on. In my childhood, I lived through things like my mother was a raging maniac, and one time she physically attacked my stepfather, and hospitalized him for weeks. I mean, these are the types of things that I saw on a regular basis. I thought that's how people lived. So when I left that environment and I came out into the world, I didn't know how to cope with normal people. I didn't know how to cope with day-to-day situations. My sponsor used to say, you're just kind of, whatever it meant, you're like Topsy, you just grew, which was a girl in an old novel. So here I was, you know, I was with these people, and we were working the steps somewhat rigidly. And I want to say this, that it's good that we all get together and that we enjoy each other's company and that we entertain each other with laughter and, you know, that. But getting down to the nuts and bolts of recovery and working these steps, it's serious business. It's life and death. I've seen people not make it. I've been sober 44 years. I've seen a lot of people come and go. And I'm not saying that from some position of, oh, whoa, look at me. I'm saying it scares the shit out of me, some of the things I've seen in the course of my lifetime. It's nice to come in here and say, you know, I got sober and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I met these people and I feel loved. You know, I do feel loved. I do. But that's not why I stayed. I stayed because I was scared shitless to go back out there. That's why I stayed. I stayed because somebody told me that if I did what was in this book, that I was going to be able to have a life. I'd never had a life. I didn't know what a life was. I thought that, you know, I thought that life was hell, to be honest with you. That's what I thought. And, you know, in the beginning, I think I just admitted I was powerless over alcohol just so y'all wouldn't make me leave. Not because I actually believed it. It took time to figure that out. It took time. It took situations when I would think to myself that, you know, this sucks, I want to drink. And then I would had been to enough meetings and talked to enough old-timers, and I mean, they were old too, you know, is that they used to say that that's a sign of alcoholism. Normal people don't think this sucks, I think I'll have a drink. Or I can't take this, I think I'll drink. Or if I can't drink, I don't want to live. Or life's no fun if I can't drink. And I mean, it just goes on and on and on, all the things. I mean, I sat down, I was sitting in that recovery home, and I tried to remember any time in my entire life I had ever done anything up to that point that didn't involve drinking. And if drinking wasn't involved, either my parents drinking or my drinking or my cousins drinking or whatever the heck, I didn't want to do it because it wasn't part of my world. I didn't eat pizza without beer. I didn't go to movies because you couldn't drink there. I just didn't. I didn't go on a picnic unless there was a cooler with alcohol in it. That was my life. So here I was. No wonder I was in horrible pain. I mean, I'm not going to say that. I've never done anything significant without alcohol. And I mean anything. Personal relationships, marital relations, nothing. I had not a clue what it would be like to live my life and do all the many things that life has to offer, to have the adventure and the experience of living without alcohol. So sure, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. I mean, my life was unmanageable. I was living on people's couches. I didn't know where my daughter was. I was unemployed and unemployable. I was already divorced, and I wasn't even 20. Couldn't even go to the 2040 meeting. Maybe sit on the porch, and I'm going to get over that resentment someday. I mean, really, I had to sit on a little bench outside the window and listen. It just killed me. And then Mike Flynn started the Young People's Solano Club, which is now, interestingly enough, some kind of a health clinic down in Mission Beach. I think it's like we go down there get tested for STD. So what can I say? But it used to be the Young People's Solano Club. I hope it didn't reflect on them at all. Anyway. Oh, my goodness. So coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, that was a little edgy for me because, you know, I grew up in a, give me that old time religion. I grew up Assembly of God, no offense to anybody here that is, you know, God bless you. But I did grow up in that particular church with the revival meetings and all that. And frankly, those people scared me almost as bad as my alcoholic parents. So I had God all mixed up. And I'm sharing this with you just so you can see how nuts I was. And you'll really appreciate me, you know, in my today person, because I'm not so crazy. Well, I'm crazy, but not that crazy. So coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, well, I thought God was nuts. So, you know, I really wasn't into that. But I was so scared. And so I let the old-timers talk to me about the higher power concept, and I read the book, and it says in the book that priests, rabbis, these ministers, these people are our friends, and we should look to them for counsel. So I began to try to develop a relationship with a higher power, and then I realized all I had to do is believe that it would be possible for a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. And I was quite willing to do, I believed that. I mean, I believed that there was a power greater than myself that kept the world spinning and, you know, all the birds and bees and ants doing what they're supposed to. That power was far greater than me. And but I think the making the decision to turn my life and my will over to God took years. And I think it was a result for me, and everything I say is just my experience. Everyone else has to have their experience. For me, it was a result of working the fourth and fifth step and the sixth and seventh step slowly as I went through that. You know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about that the fourth step is the beginning of a lifetime process. And I want to tell you, I wish I had $5 for every inventory I ever wrote. You know, of course, I'd have to give it back to the poor person that had to listen to it. But, you know, the thing of it is that as my feelings began to come up inside me, there were so many things I didn't understand because I'd never lived in a life where I ever had to feel my feelings. You know, I don't want to divert from hardcore AA because I've heard that there are some folks afoot that feel that, you know, we should only talk about alcoholism. Well, what is alcoholism? What is alcoholism? Alcoholism is the personification of me, that girl who couldn't live a 24-hour period without alcohol. And when she did have to live with alcohol, couldn't live. That's what the ism of it is. You can't live with it, and you can't live without it. It's just like being married. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. That was bad. That was a bad joke. Marriage is okay. You know. So I had to learn to live with myself, and I had to try things. I remember I was sober like 2 years, and I went to see a movie. I was terrified. Now, maybe no one here is that sick, and God bless you, I hope to hell you're not. But, you know, I had lived in this cloistered world where I didn't allow it was like living life in a straitjacket. I was so afraid to do anything outside the boundaries of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to work. I went to school. I went to AA. That's it. So I went to see this movie, Good Neighbor Sam, Jack Nicholson. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it because I genuinely laughed sober for the first time in my life. I laughed and I laughed. Not that hysterical mania laugh that we get sometimes when we're talking about our drinking with each other. I mean, it's just like, it's so horrible. You just kind of have to have a manic experience. But, you know, this was like actually laughing at this movie. And I thought, I'm alive. I'm alive. I'm a person. I'm alive. I can do this. I can do this thing sober. And I've done a lot of things sober. I forgot to ask, what time does this meeting end? 9:45?
No.
That's what with you. Gotcha, didn't I? 8:45? Somebody give me a clue. I trust 8:09, in 10 minutes. Okay. This is the deal. In Alcoholics Anonymous, these are the things that I've done. And I want to talk about these things because we live here. We don't live in these meetings. We live here. We live here in this society, in this world. We have to become a friend among many. You know? It says, never have we sought to be one among many, a friend among friends in the society we live in. That's the goal of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what the steps are about. That's what the accomplishment is for me. It's wonderful to come in here. I love being with Alcoholics Anonymous people. It's when I feel safe. Because not you people, but the people before you, and you as well, you're the ones who loved me until I was able to love myself. You're the ones who said to me, it's going to be okay, you know, you're scared, but, you know, there's nothing to be, you know, fear can't hurt you. Only thing that can hurt you is reaching out again for alcohol and drugs. You know, I can't, and back then there was nothing to help us come down. I mean, Jesus, we took vitamin B and drank honey and orange juice. That's what we did. Thank you. Honey and orange juice and vitamin B shots. I mean, some little guy came and shot us in the butt with vitamin B. So I was coming down off speed, methylphenidate, alcohol, and a horrible childhood. That's a hell of a combo. So my goal at some point, after writing and writing and talking and talking and writing and writing and talking and talking, writing those four steps, I say, write. If you're having feelings and you don't know what those feelings are, and those feelings feel like they own you, and you feel like you're going to go nuts, and you're having thoughts that you don't want anybody else to know you're having, get a piece of paper, a pencil, and start writing and be honest. Put all that stuff down on a piece of paper, and then go to someone and talk to that person, someone you can trust. Be careful. You can't trust all of us because you don't come here because you're well-wired. You know, so you make sure that you go talk, that you've watched the person for a while and you can trust them with your information. Doesn't, you know, for me, I was in therapy for some years, and that's a good thing. But if the therapist is also a recovering person, that's a good thing. But for me, it was good for me to go to a trusted member of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about these feelings and tell them the nutty stuff I was thinking. And, oh, I was a handful. So after doing that for a long time, many, many times, not just one time, I sometimes a little part of me just kind of shivers and shrinks when I hear somebody say, yeah, you know, I did my fourth and fifth step, did it about 5 years ago, and I'm good. And I look at them and I watch them. I'm a watcher. I learned to be a watcher in my alcoholic home. I watch people and I read them like a book, and it's the truth. It's a great survival skill. It served me well in recovery. And sometimes when a person says that, my heart goes out to them. Because if it was that damn simple, we wouldn't have tried to drink ourselves to death, now would we? So after all that writing and talking and talking and writing and writing and talking, I came to a point where I really realized what a wonderful gift life is. What a wonderful thing. That, because, you know, when I was drinking, I used to pray to God that I could control absolutely everything in my life each day. I had so many fears of this might happen or that might happen, or what if this did or what if that did. And after years of working the steps and coming into these rooms and working on myself and having those quiet moments of sheer horror when I realized how far off base I can get, and that still happens. You know, after all of those experiences of living, I've come to understand that none of us know what the hell's going to happen next. It's silly to even waste my energy that way. I have a responsibility to myself and to you to be the very best person I can be today, to be as honest as I possibly can with myself and with you, and honest with my finances and honest with my relationships. I do the very best I can. I used to say, when I was a young woman and my child was young, my children were young, I used to say to myself, there was this one little thing I used to think, you know, as long as my children are healthy and fine, as long as I'm doing my best every day and making a good life for them, I can do this. But God forbid if anything should happen to one of my children. God forbid. Well, alcoholism is a genetic condition. I mean, that's actually true, you know, medically speaking. You ask any doctor. So I gave my little girls the best life I could give them. That was from the first marriage to an alcoholic guy. He later drank, and just to give you, he drank, he moved on out of my life, and there's been a different marriage since then. But we had these little girls, and they had a good life. I gave them the life I'd never had, sober mom, and, and all that. Well, both my daughters turned out to have alcoholism, both of them. Different types of alcoholism. You know, there are types, whether we like it or not. My one daughter was a periodic, you know, she'd go along just fine and then, you know, go on a binge. That's the kind of drinker her father was, a periodic binge drinker. I was a devoted, dedicated, committed alcoholic. I drank, and that was my life. That was it. I didn't have to be distracted. I knew what I was going to do every day. That's the way my oldest daughter drank. And, you know, she was wild. I was wild. You probably wouldn't think that of me, but I was wild when I drank. My cousins used to just cover their eyes in horror. we'd go out on the Indian reservation where no one could catch us, and we would drink all night and have a bonfire, and I was just a wild thing. My daughter was like me. She was wild. And she was completely devoted to her alcoholism and to just living life on the edge, kind of a dangerous life, you know. And so in 1994, my daughter was murdered as a result of her alcoholism, the people she associated with and the things that she did and the places she went. And I stayed sober through that. I did. I stayed sober, and I was able to take her three little children who had been living that life of hell that I once lived, and I understood. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, can't be a situation where I come in here and think just so long as I, you know, have real gold earrings and get to drive a nice car and have a good job, I'm going to stay sober as long as my kids are healthy. Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, is something is different than that. It's a program of recovery that has so many facets to it that's here for me and for you and for whatever life hands you. You know, I pray to God we all live happily ever after in AA land. That would be a lot of fun. But just in case it doesn't work out like that for you, let me assure you that no matter what, one day at a time, for the rest of your life, if you choose, you can stay sober. You know, it was an adventure raising my grandchildren. They're fabulous, fabulous people. My 26-year-old is married and has a little boy and lives in Virginia. I married a man, a normal man, at least he said he was, and he kept trying to convince me, but I'm not sure. You know, he sure did give me a good life, that man. And he had a boy when we got married. And my son, he lives in Virginia. He's a retired NFL player. And I talk about that from the podium because these are some of the hopes and dreams that can come true. You know, I wouldn't have had the life I've had. I wouldn't have been able to. My daughter was going to die anyway. That's the deal. There was nothing I could do to stop my daughter from being murdered because that was her life that she was choosing. It was her life she was living, not mine. But because of my higher power and because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of the internal strength that I've gained over the years, I was able to get those kids all the help they needed, you know. And my 22-year-old is running back for University of Utah his senior year. And my 20-year-old, she's kind of more like me. She ran away and had a baby, and, you know, she's kind of doing it the hard way. But that's okay. She's taking responsibility, and she doesn't drink. She has epilepsy, and it's always been made clear to her that, you know, her epilepsy is in remission and that if she drinks that she'll have seizures again. So she's doing life the hard way in the raw. You know, at least when we drink, we're a little oblivious once in a while to the shit we're getting ourselves into. I remain supportive to her. And my older daughter, my surviving daughter, who's 40, lives in Oregon, and God bless her. And she's sober and kind of does white-knuckle sobriety from time to time, but that's also none of my business. There's only one person on this planet that I am responsible to and for, and that's me. And I can live each day to the best of my ability and try to be a helpful example and be there for someone if they call. I can offer my experience and strength and my hope because it surely has freely been offered to me. I have wonderful companionship in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm real grateful for the fact that my husband died in December. He died of cancer, and cancer related to his time served in Vietnam. And, you know, I would slip into the meeting on Sunday morning. It's the only meeting I could really get out to, and I would just sit there amongst the people and just know that I was okay, and that when this was over, you know, I promised him I would take care of him, and he wouldn't have to go to the VA hospital. He was horrified of the VA hospital for some reason. Well, he spent a long time there because he was horribly wounded in Vietnam. But I took care of him and every day for the end of his illness, and he died at home, like I promised. And that's the thing Alcoholics Anonymous allows us. We get to keep our promises. When we're drinking, we don't keep promises. You can, I promised you something you could be sure one damn thing it wasn't going to happen. That's something you could be pretty darn sure of in my drinking days. But now, you know, I wake up just like, and it's been like this for years, even in the midst of all of those things that in life we say are objectionable, I truly, God as my witness, wake up every single day grateful to be me, grateful to be sober, grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor told me, there's a lot of nice people in the world who will do a lot of nice things for you, but at some point you have to be there for you. And how you do that is you go to meetings, you don't drink, you don't use drugs, you work the steps, and you get with people you can trust. Be careful. Be careful who you hand your heart to. Because that's your life you're playing with, you know? Together, when somebody comes to me, that's a cherished experience because that person is trusting me, you know? And I expect them to be trustworthy. And I have a great life. I'm here to tell you, I am one. Well, geez, if I was, what's her name, Palin, I'd just say I'm a maverick. Because I do. This is the deal. This is what I've learned in recovery. I can do any damn thing I want to, just so long as it doesn't harm myself or anybody else. I can explore anything on this planet I want to explore. I can do anything. I just can't drink and use drugs. That's all. And I have to come to these damn meetings and work these steps, but that's fun too. Thanks a lot.